Why should I not share it with those who seek my help? Does your help ever come without a price?
My legs gave out. I plunged to my knees, the frigid water up to my chin. Please, Trophonius, I am mortal now. Take your price from me, not her.
The girl has already volunteered. She opened her deepest fears and regrets to me.
No. No, she didn't drink of the two springs. Her mind is not prepared. She will die. Images flickered through Trophonius's dark form like flashes of lightning. Meg encased in goo in the ant's lair. Meg standing between me and the Tirses. His sword stopped cold by her crossed golden blades. Meg hugging me fiercely as we flew our griffin from the Indianapolis Zoo.
She is precious to you,
said the oracle.
Would you give your life in exchange for hers?
I had trouble processing that question. Give up my life? At any point in my 4,000 years of existence, my answer would have been an emphatic no. Are you crazy? One should never give up one's life. One's life is important. The whole point of my quests in the mortal world, finding and securing all these ancient oracles, was to regain immortality so I wouldn't have to ponder such awful questions. And yet, I thought of Emmy and Josephine renouncing immortality for each other. I thought of Calypso giving up her home, her powers, and eternal life for a chance to roam the world, experience love, and possibly enjoy the wonders of high school in Indiana. Yes, I found myself saying. Yes, I would die to save Meg McCaffrey. Trophonius laughed, a wet, angry sound like the churning of vipers in water.
Very good. Then promise me that you'll grant me a wish. Whatever I ask, you will do.
Your wish. I wasn't a god anymore. Trophonius knew that. Even if I could grant wishes, I seemed to recall a very recent conversation with the goddess Styx about the dangers of making oaths I couldn't keep. But what choice did I have? Yes, I said. I swear. Whatever you ask. Then we have an agreement? You will take me instead of the girl?
Oh, I didn't promise anything in return.
The spirit turned as black as oil smoke.
I just wanted to exact that promise from you. The girl's fate is already decided.
He stretched out his arms, expelling millions of dark, ghostly bees. Meg screamed in terror as the swarm engulfed her. 35. Man, I hate my son. A real arrogant jerkwad. Nothing like his dad. I did not know I could move so fast. Not as Lester Papadopoulos, anyway. I bounded across the lake until I reached Meg's side. I tried desperately to shoo away the bees, but the wisps of darkness swarmed her, flying into her mouth, nose, and ears, even into her tear ducts. As a god of medicine, I would have found that fascinating if I hadn't been so repulsed. Trophonius, stop it! I pleaded.
This is not my doing, said the spirit. Your friend opened her mind to the dark oracle. She asked questions. Now she is receiving the answers.
She asked no questions.
Oh, but she did. Mostly about you, father. What will happen to you? Where must you go? How can she help you? These worries are foremost in her mind. Such misplaced loyalty.
Meg began to thrash. I turned her onto her side, as one should do for someone having a seizure. I racked my brain. What else? remove sharp objects from her environment. All the snakes were gone, good. Not much I could do about the bees. Her skin was cold, but I had nothing warm and dry to cover her with. Her usual scent, that faint, inexplicable smell of apples, had turned dank as mildew. The rhinestones in her glasses were completely dark, the lenses white with condensation. Meg, I said, stay with me. Concentrate on my voice. She muttered incoherently. With a twinge of panic, I realized that if she gave me a direct order in her delirious state, even something as simple as leave me alone or go away, I would be compelled to obey. I had to find a way to anchor her mind, to shield her from the worst of the dark visions. That was difficult when my own mind was still a little fuzzy and not completely trustworthy. I muttered some healing chants, old curative tunes I hadn't used in centuries. Before antibiotics, before aspirin, before even sterile bandages, we had songs. I was the god of both music and healing for good reason. One should never underestimate the healing power of music. Meg's breathing steadied, but the shadowy swarm still enveloped her. Attracted to her fears and doubts like, well, like bees to pollen.
Ahem, Trophonius said. So about this favor you promised?
Shut up, I snapped. In her fever, Meg murmured, shut up. I chose to take this as an echo, not an order, aimed at Trophonius rather than me. Thankfully, my vocal cords agreed. I sang to Meg about her mother, Demeter, the goddess who could heal the entire earth after drought, fire, or flood. I sang of Demeter's mercy and kindness, the way she had made the prince Triptolemus into a god because of his good deeds, the way she had nursed the baby boy Demophon for 3 nights, attempting to make him immortal, the way she had blessed the cereal makers of modern times, flooding the world with a bounty of Fruit Loops, Lucky Charms, and Count Chocula. Truly, she was a goddess of infinite benevolence. You know she loves you, I promised, cradling Meg's head in my lap. She loves all her children. Look at how much she cherished Persephone, even though that girl... Well, she makes your table manners look positively refined. No offense. I realized I wasn't even singing anymore. I was rambling, trying to drive off Meg's fears with a friendly voice. Once, I continued, Demeter married this minor harvest god, Carmenor. You've probably never heard of him. No one had. He was this local deity in Crete, rude, backward, poorly dressed. But oh, they loved each other. They had this son, ugliest boy you ever saw, had no redeeming qualities. He looked like a pig, everyone said so. He even had a horrible name. Ebolius. Sounds like Ebola, I know. But Demeter turned everyone's criticisms around. She made Ebolius the god of swineherds. I only say this because... Well, you never know, Meg. Demeter has plans for you, I'm sure. Can't die on me, you see. You have too much to look forward to. Demeter might make you the minor goddess of cute little piglets. I couldn't tell if she was hearing me. Her eyes shifted under closed lids as if she'd entered REM sleep. She wasn't twitching and thrashing quite as much. Was that my imagination? I was shaking from cold and fear so much myself, it was hard to be sure. Trophonius made a sound like a steam valve opening.
She's just fallen into a deeper trance. That's not necessarily a good sign. She could still die.
I kept my back to him. Meg, don't listen to Trophonius. He's all about fear and pain. He's just trying to make us lose hope.
Hope,
said the spirit.
Interesting word. I had hope once that my father might act like a father. I got over it after a few centuries of being dead.
Don't blame me for you robbing the king's treasury, I snarled. You are here because you messed up.
I prayed to you.
Well, perhaps you didn't pray for the right thing at the right time, I yelled. Pray for wisdom before you do something stupid. Don't pray for me to bail you out after you follow your worst instincts. The bees swirled around me and buzzed angrily, but they did me no harm. I refused to offer them any fear to feed on. All that mattered now was staying positive, staying anchored for Meg's sake. I'm here. I brushed the wet hair from her forehead. You are not alone. She whimpered in her trance. The rose died. I felt as if a water moccasin had wriggled into my chest and was biting my heart, one artery at a time. Meg, a flower is only part of the plant. Flowers grow back. You have deep roots. You have strong stems. You have... Your face is green. I turned to Trophonius in alarm. Why is her face green?
Interesting. He sounded anything but interested. Perhaps she's dying.
He tilted his head as if listening to something in the distance.
Ah, they're here, waiting for you.
What? Who?
The Emperor's servants. Blemii.
Trophonius gestured to the far side of the lake.
An underwater tunnel just there. It leads into the rest of the cavern system, the part known to mortals. The Blemii have learned better than to come into this chamber, but they're waiting for you on the other end. That's the only way you can escape.
Then we will.
Doubtful, said Trophonius. Even if your young friend survives, the Blemii are preparing explosives.
What?
Oh, Commodus probably told them to use the explosives only as a last resort. He likes having me as his personal fortune teller. He sends his men in here from time to time, pulls them out half dead and insane, gets free glimpses of the future. What does he care? But he'd rather destroy this oracle than allow you to escape alive.
I was too dumbfounded to respond. Trophonius let loose another harsh peal of laughter.
Don't look so down, Apollo. On the bright side, it won't matter if Meg dies here, because she's going to die anyway. Look, she's frothing at the mouth now. This is always the most interesting part.
Meg was indeed gurgling white foam. In my expert medical opinion, that was rarely a good sign. I took her face between my hands. Meg, listen to me. The darkness roiled around her, making my skin tingle. I'm here. I'm Apollo, god of healing. You will not die on me. Meg didn't take orders well. I knew this. She twitched and foamed, coughing up random words like horse, crossword, cloven, roots. Also not a great sign, medically speaking. My singing had not worked. Stern language had not worked. There was only one other remedy I could think of. An ancient technique for drawing out poison and evil spirits. The practice was no longer endorsed by most medical associations, but I remembered the limerick from the Grove of Dodona, the line I had lost the most sleep over. Was forced death and madness to swallow. Here we were. I knelt over Meg's face, as I used to do when I taught mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as part of first aid training at Camp Jupiter. Those silly Roman demigods were always drowning. I'm sorry about this. I pinched Meg's nose and clamped my mouth over hers. A slimy, unpleasant sensation, much like what I imagined Poseidon experienced when he realized he was kissing the Gorgon Medusa. I could not be deterred. Instead of exhaling, I inhaled, sucking the darkness from Meg's lungs. Perhaps at some point in your life you've gotten water up your nose. Imagine that feeling, except with bee venom and acid instead of water. The pain almost made me black out, a noxious cloud of horror flooding through my sinuses, down my throat, and into my chest. I felt ghostly bees ricocheting through my respiratory system, trying to sting their way out. I held my breath, determined to keep as much of the darkness away from Meg for as long as I could. I would share this burden with her, even if it killed me. My mind slid sideways into Meg's own memories. I was a frightened little girl, trembling on the steps of the library, staring down at the body of my murdered father. The rose he had given me was crushed and dead. Its petals were scattered across the wounds the beast had made in his belly. The beast had done this. I had no doubt. Nero had warned me again and again. Daddy had promised me the rose would never die. I would never have to worry about thorns. He said the flower was a gift from my mother, a lady I had never met. But the rose was dead. Daddy was dead. My life was nothing but thorns. Nero put his hand on my shoulder. I'm so sorry, Meg. His eyes were sad, but his voice was tinged with disappointment. This only proved what I had already suspected. Daddy's death was my fault. I should have been a better daughter. I should have trained harder, minded my manners, not objected when Nero told me to fight the larger children, or the animals I did not want to kill. I had upset the beast. I sobbed, hating myself. Nero hugged me. I buried my face in his purple clothes, his sickly sweet cologne, not like flowers, but like old desiccated potpourri in a nursing home. I wasn't sure how I even knew that smell, but it brought back a half-remembered feeling of helplessness and terror. Nero was all I had. I didn't get real flowers, a real father, a real mother. I wasn't worthy of that. I had to cling to what I had. Then, our minds co-mingled, Meg and I plunged into primordial chaos, the miasma from which the fates wove the future, making destiny out of randomness. No one's mind should be exposed to such power. Even as a god, I feared to go too near the boundaries of chaos. It was the same sort of danger mortals risked when they asked to see a god's true form. A burning, terrible pyre of pure possibility. Seeing such a thing could vaporize humans, turn them into salt or dust. I shielded Meg from the miasma as best I could, wrapping my mind around hers in a sort of embrace. But we both heard the piercing voices. Swift white horse, they whispered. The crossword speaker. Lands of scorching death. And more, lines spoken too fast, overlapping too much to make sense of. My eyes began to bake. The bees consumed my lungs, still I held my breath. I saw a misty river in the distance, the Styx itself. The dark goddess beckoned me from the shore, inviting me to cross. I would be immortal again. If only in the way human souls were immortal after death. I could pass into the fields of punishment. Didn't I deserve to be punished for my many crimes? Unfortunately, Meg felt the same way. Guilt weighed her down. She did not believe she deserved to survive. What saved us was a simultaneous thought. I cannot give up. Apollo, Meg, needs me. I endured for another moment, then two. At last, I could stand it no more. I exhaled, expelling the poison of the prophecy, gasping for fresh air. I collapsed next to Meg on the cold, wet stone. Slowly, the world returned to a solid state. The voices were gone, the cloud of ghostly bees had vanished. I rose to my elbows. I pressed my fingers against Meg's neck. Her pulse pattered, thready and weak, but she was not dead. "Thank the three fates," I murmured. For once, I actually meant it. If Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos had been in front of me right then, I would have kissed their warty noses. On his island, Trophonius sighed.
"Oh, well. The girl might still be insane for the rest of her life. That's some consolation."
I glared at my deceased son. "Some consolation?"
"Yes."
He tilted his ethereal head, listening again.
"You'd best hurry. You'll have to carry the girl through the underwater tunnel, so I suppose you might both drown.
Or the Blemyai might kill you at the other end. But if not, I want that favor."
I laughed. After my plunge into chaos, it wasn't a pretty sound. "You expect a favor? For attacking a defenseless girl?"
"For giving you your prophecy,"
Trophonius corrected.
"It's yours, assuming you can extract it from the girl on the throne of memory. Now my favor, as you promised. Destroy this cave."
I had to admit, I'd just come back from the miasma of pure prophecy, and I still didn't see that request coming. "Say what now?"
"This location is too exposed," said Trophonius. "Your allies at the way station will never be able to defend it from the Triumvirate. The Emperors will just keep attacking. I do not wish to be used by Commodus anymore. Better that the Oracle is destroyed."
I wondered if Zeus would agree. I had been operating under the assumption that my father wanted me to restore all the ancient oracles before I could regain my godhood. I wasn't sure if destroying the cavern of Trophonius would be an acceptable plan B. Then again, if Zeus wanted things done in a certain way, he should have given me instructions in writing. "But Trophonius, what will happen to you?" Trophonius shrugged.
"Perhaps my oracle will reappear somewhere else in a few centuries. Under better circumstances, in a more secure location. Maybe that will give you time to become a nicer father."
He was definitely making it easier to consider his request. "How do I destroy this place?"
"I may have mentioned the Blemyai with explosives in the next cave. If they do not use them, you must."
"And Agamethus? Will he disappear as well?" Dim flashes of light erupted from within the spirit's form. "Perhaps sadness?"
"Eventually," said Trophonius. "Tell Agamethus. Tell him I love him. And I'm sorry this has been our fate. That's more than I ever got from you."
His swirling column of darkness began to unspool.
"Wait!"
I yelled.
"What about Georgina? Where did Agamethus find her? Is she my child?"
The laughter of Trophonius echoed weakly through the cavern.
"Ah, yes. Consider that mystery my last gift to you, father. I hope it drives you insane."
Then he was gone. For a moment, I sat on the ledge, stunned and devastated. I didn't feel physically hurt, but I realized it was possible to suffer 1,000 bites in this snake pit
even if none of the vipers came near you. There were other kinds of poison. The cave rumbled, sending ripples across the lake. I didn't know what that meant, but we could not stay here. I lifted Meg in my arms and waded into the water. 36. Mind your P's and Q's. When you are arming bombs or splat. Trample jelly. I may have mentioned I am not the god of the sea. I have many fascinating abilities. In my divine state, I am good at nearly everything I attempt. But as Lester Papadopoulos, I was not the master of one-armed swimming underwater while encumbered, nor could I go without oxygen any longer than a normal mortal. I clawed my way through the passage, hugging Meg close, my lungs burning in outrage. First you fill us with dark prophetic bees, my lungs screamed at me. Now you force us to stay underwater. You are a horrible person. I could only hope Meg would survive the experience. Since she was still unconscious, I couldn't very well warn her to hold her breath. The best I could do was make our journey as brief as possible. At least the current was in my favor. The water pushed me in the direction I wanted to go. But after 6 or 7 seconds, I was pretty sure we were going to die. My ears throbbed. I groped blindly for handholds on the slick rock walls. I was probably destroying my fingertips, but the cold rendered my nervous system useless. The only pain I felt was inside my chest and head. My mind began to play tricks on me as it sought more oxygen. You can breathe underwater, it said. Go ahead, it'll be fine. I was about to inhale the river when I noticed a faint green glow above me. Air? Radiation? Limeade? Any of those sounded better than drowning in the dark. I kicked upward. I expected to be surrounded by enemies when I surfaced, so I tried to emerge with as little gasping and flailing as possible. I made sure Meg's head was above water, then gave her a quick abdominal thrust to expel any fluid from her lungs. That's what friends are for. Doing all this quietly was no easy task. But as soon as I took in our surroundings, I was glad to be such a ninja of soft gasping and flailing. This cave was not much larger than the one we had left. Electric lamps hung from the ceiling, casting green streaks of light across the water. Along the opposite side of the cave, a boat dock was lined with boxy aluminum barges. For touring the mortally accessible areas of the subterranean river, I assumed. On the dock, 3 Blemyai crouched over a large object that looked like 2 scuba tanks duct-taped together, the cracks stuffed with wads of putty and lots of wires. Had Leo Valdez made such a contraption, it could have been anything from a robotic butler to a jetpack. Given the Blemyai's lack of creativity, I came to the depressing conclusion that they were arming a bomb. The only reasons they had not noticed and killed us already were, 1, they were busy arguing, and 2, they were not looking in our direction. Blemyai's peripheral vision consists entirely of their own armpits, so they tend to focus straight ahead. 1 Blemyai was dressed in dark green slacks and an open green dress shirt. A park ranger's outfit, perhaps? The 2nd wore the blue uniform of an Indiana state trooper. The 3rd, oh dear, she wore a very familiar-looking flowery dress.
No siree,
the trooper yelled as politely as possible.
That is not where the red wire goes, thank you very much.
You're welcome, said the ranger. But I studied the diagram. It does go there, you see, because the blue wire has to go here. And if you'll excuse me for saying so, you're an idiot.
You're excused, the trooper said amiably. But only because you're an idiot.
Now, boys, said the woman.
Her voice was definitely that of Nanette, the woman who had welcomed us on our first day in Indianapolis. It seemed impossible that she should have regenerated from Tartarus so soon after being killed by Josephine's crossbow turret, but I put this down to my usual wretched luck.
Let's not argue. We can just call the customer support line and...
Meg took this opportunity to gasp, much louder than I had. We had no place to hide except underwater, and I wasn't in any shape to submerge again. Nanette spotted us. Her chest face twisted in a smile, her heavy orange lipstick glistening like mud in the green light.
Well, looky here. Visitors.
The ranger unsheathed a hunting knife. The trooper drew his gun. Even with his species' bad depth perception, he wasn't likely to miss us at such close range. Helpless in the water, holding a gasping, half-conscious Meg, I did the only thing I could think of. I yelled, "Don't kill us!" Nanette chuckled.
"Now, honey, why shouldn't we kill you?"
I glanced at the scuba tank bomb. No doubt Leo Valdez would know exactly what to do in a situation like this, but the only advice I could think of was something Calypso had told me at the zoo. Half of magic is acting like it will work. The other half is picking a superstitious mark.
"You should not kill me," I announced, "because I know where the red wire goes."
The Blemyai muttered among themselves. They may have been immune to charm and music, but they shared mortals' reluctance for either reading instructions or calling customer support. Their hesitation gave me a moment to slap Meg,
gently on the cheek,
simply to help her wake up. She spluttered and twitched, which was an improvement over being passed out cold. I scanned the cave for possible escape routes. To our right, the river wound through a low-ceilinged tunnel. I was not anxious to swim through these caves any longer. To our left, at the edge of the boat dock, a ramp with railings led upward. That would be the exit to the surface, I decided. Unfortunately, standing in our way were three super-strong humanoids with an explosive device. The Blemyai concluded their conference. Nanette faced me again.
"Very well. Please tell us where the red wire goes. Then we will kill you as painlessly as possible, and we can all go home happy."
"A generous offer," I said. "But I really need to show you. It's too hard to explain from way over here. Permission to come ashore?" The trooper lowered his gun. A bushy mustache covered the width of his lowest rib.
"Well, he asked permission. That was polite."
Nanette stroked her chin, simultaneously scratching her belly.
"Permission granted."
Joining three enemies on the dock was only marginally better than freezing in the river, but I was glad to get Meg out of the water. "Thank you," I told the Blemyai after they hauled us up.
"You're welcome,"
all three said in unison.
"Just let me put my friend down."
I stumbled toward the ramp, wondering if I could make a break for it.
"That's far enough," Nanette warned. "Please and thank you."
There were no ancient Greek words for "I hate you, scary clown woman," but I muttered a close approximation under my breath. I propped Meg against the wall.
"Can you hear me?"
I whispered. Her lips were the color of blueberries. Her teeth chattered, her eyes rolled back in her head, showing the bloodshot whites of her eyes.
"Meg, please," I said. "I will distract the Blemyai, but you need to get out of here. Can you walk? Crawl? Anything?"
Meg shivered and gasped.
"Shuma, shuma."
This was no language that I knew, but I inferred that Meg would not be going anywhere on her own. I would have to do more than just distract the Blemmyai.
All righty then, Nanette said. Please show us what you know so we can bring down this cave on top of you.
I forced a smile.
Of course. Now, let's see.
I knelt next to the device. It was sadly uncomplicated. There were, in fact, only two wires and two receptors, both color-coded blue and red. I glanced up.
Quick question.
I am aware that Blemmyai are tone-deaf, but...
That's not true.
The ranger looked offended.
I don't even know what that means.
The other two bowed emphatically, the Blemmyai equivalent of nodding.
I enjoy all tones, Nanette agreed.
Explosions, the trooper said. Gunshots, car engines, all tones are good.
I stand corrected, I said. But my question was, could it be possible that your species is also colorblind?
They looked dumbfounded.
I examined Nanette's makeup, dress, and shoes once again, and it became clear to me why so many Blemmyai preferred to disguise themselves in mortal uniforms. Of course they were colorblind.
For the record, I am not implying that colorblindness or tone deafness indicate any lack of creativity or intelligence. Far from it. Some of my favorite creative people, from Mark Twain to Mr. Rogers to William Butler Yeats, had these conditions. In Blemmyai, however, sensory limitations and dull thinking seem to be part of the same depressing package.
Forget it, I said. Let's get started. Nanette, would you please pick up the red wire?
Well, since you asked so nicely.
Nanette leaned in and picked up the blue wire.
The other red wire, I advised.
Of course, I knew that.
She took the red wire. Now attach it to the red...
To this receptor, I pointed. Nanette did as I instructed.
There you are,
I said. Clearly still perplexed, the Blemmyai stared at the device. The trooper said,
But there's another wire.
Yes, I said patiently. It goes to the second receptor. However, I grabbed Nanette's hand before she could blow us all up.
Once you connect it, you will most likely activate the bomb. Do you see this small screen here?
I am no Hephaestus, but I assume this is the timer. Do you happen to know what the default countdown is?
The trooper and ranger conferred in the guttural monotone language of the Blemmyai, which sounded like two busted power sanders speaking in Morse code.
I glanced over at Meg, who was right where I'd left her, still shivering and muttering shuma shuma under her breath. The ranger smiled in a self-satisfied way.
Well, sir, since I'm the only one who read the diagram, I've decided I can safely give you the answer. The default time is 5 seconds.
Ah.
A few phantom bees crawled up my throat.
So once you connect the wire, there will be virtually no time to exit the cave before the bomb goes off.
Exactly, Nanette beamed. The Emperor was very clear. If Apollo and the child make it out of the Oracle Chamber, kill them and bring down the cavern in a mighty explosion.
The trooper frowned.
No, he said to kill them with the mighty explosion.
No siree, said the ranger. He said to use the mighty explosion only if we had to. We could kill these two if they appeared, but if they didn't...
He scratched his shoulder hair.
I'm confused now. What was the bomb for?
I said a silent prayer of thanks that Commodus had sent Blemmyai and not Germani to do this job. Of course, that probably meant the Germani were fighting my friends at the way station right now. But I could only handle one earth-shattering crisis at a time.
Friends,
I said. Frenemies, Blemyai. My point is this. If you activate the bomb, the three of you will die too.
Are you prepared for that?
Nanette's smile melted. Oh.
I've got it!
The ranger wagged his finger at me enthusiastically.
Why don't you connect the wire after the three of us leave?
Don't be silly, said the trooper. He won't kill himself and the girl just because we ask him to.
He gave me a cautiously hopeful glance.
Will you?
It doesn't matter, Nanette chided. The Emperor told us to kill Apollo and the girl, not to have them do it themselves. The others mumbled agreement. Following orders to the letter was everything, of course. I have an idea, I said, when in fact I did not. I had been hoping to come up with some clever plan to overpower the Blemyai and get Meg out of there. So far, no clever plan had materialized. There was also the matter of my promise to Trophonius. I had sworn to destroy his oracle. I preferred to do that without destroying myself. The Blemyai waited politely for me to continue. I tried to channel some of Calypso's bravado. Oh, gods, please never tell her I drew on her for inspiration. It's true, you have to kill us yourselves, I began. And I do understand. But I have a solution that will accomplish all your goals. A mighty explosion, destroying the oracle, killing us, and getting out alive. Nanette nodded. That last one is a bonus for sure. There's an underwater tunnel just here. I explained how Meg and I had swum through from Trophonius's chamber. To effectively destroy the oracle room, you can't set the bomb off here. Someone would have to swim with the device deep inside the tunnel, activate the timer, and swim back out. Now, I am not strong enough, but a Blemyai could do this easily.
The trooper frowned. But 5 seconds. Is that enough time?
Ah, I said. But it's a well-known fact that underwater, timers take twice as long, so you'd actually have 10 seconds. Nanette blinked. Are you sure about that?
The ranger elbowed her.
He just said it was a well-known fact. Don't be impolite.
The trooper scratched his mustache with the barrel of his gun, which was probably against department safety protocols.
I'm still not sure why we have to destroy the Oracle. Why can't we just kill you two, say, with this gun, and leave the Oracle alone?
I sighed. If only we could. But my friend, it's not safe. This girl and I got in and got out with our prophecy, didn't we? That means other trespassers can too.
Surely that's what the Emperor meant about the mighty explosion. You don't want to have to come back here with your bomb every time someone breaks in, do you?
The trooper looked horrified.
Goodness, no.
And leaving the oracle intact, in this place where mortals obviously have guided tours, well, that's a safety hazard. Not closing off the oracle's cave would be very discourteous of us. All three Blemyai nodded, bowed earnestly. But, Nanette said, if you're trying to trick us somehow, and I apologize for raising that possibility.
No, I said. I fully understand.
How about this? Go set the bomb. If you come back safely and the cave blows up on schedule, then you can do us the courtesy of killing us quickly and painlessly. If something goes wrong,
then we can rip your limbs off,
the trooper suggested.
And trample your bodies into jelly, added the ranger.
That's a marvelous idea.
Thank you.
I tried to keep my queasiness under control.
You're most welcome.
Nanette studied the bomb.
perhaps sensing that something was still off about my plan. Thank the gods, she either didn't see it or was too polite to mention her reservations.
Well, she said at last, in that case, I'll be back.
She scooped up the tanks and leaped into the water, which gave me a few luxurious seconds to come up with a plan to avoid getting trampled into jelly. At last, things were looking up. 37. Your favorite fruit? I hope you didn't say grapes, or apples, or figs. Poor Nanette. I wonder what went through her mind when she realized that a 5-second timer underwater still lasted exactly 5 seconds. As the device exploded, I imagine she bubbled out one last vile curse like, "Oh, gosh darn it." I might have felt sorry for her had she not been planning to kill me. The cave shook. Chunks of wet stalactite dropped into the lake and whanged against the hulls of the barges. A burst of air erupted from the middle of the lake, upheaving the dock and filling the cavern with the scent of tangerine lipstick. The trooper and the ranger frowned at me.
You blew up Nanette. That was not polite.
Hold on, I yelped. She's probably still swimming back. It's a long tunnel.
This bought me another 3 or 4 seconds, during which a clever escape plan still did not present itself. At the very least, I hoped Nanette's death had not been in vain. I hoped the explosion had destroyed the cave of the Oracle, as Trophonius wished. But I could not be certain. Meg was still only half conscious, muttering and shivering. I had to get her back to the way station and set her on the throne of memory quickly. But two Blemyai still stood in my way. My hands were too numb to be any good with a bow or a ukulele. I wished I had some other weapon. Even a magical Brazilian handkerchief that I could wave in my enemies' faces. Oh, if only a surge of divine strength would course through my body. At last, the ranger sighed.
All right, Apollo. Would you prefer we stomp or dismember you first? It's only right you get to choose.
That's very polite, I agreed.
Then I gasped. Oh my gods, look over there! You must forgive me. I realize that this method of distraction is the oldest trick in the book. In fact, it is a trick so old it predates papyrus scrolls and was first recorded on clay tablets in Mesopotamia. But the Blemyai fell for it. They were slow at looking over there. They could not glance. They could not turn their heads without turning their entire bodies. So they executed a full 180-degree waddle. I had no follow-up trick in mind. I simply knew I had to save Meg and get out of there. Then an aftershock rattled the cavern, unbalancing the Blemyai, and I took advantage. I kicked the ranger into the lake. At precisely the same moment, a portion of the ceiling peeled loose and fell on top of said ranger like a hailstorm of major appliances. The ranger disappeared under churning foam. I could only stare in amazement. I was fairly sure I hadn't caused the ceiling to crack and collapse. Blind luck? Or perhaps the spirit of Trophonius had granted me one last grudging favor for destroying his cave. Crushing someone under a rain of rocks did seem like the sort of favor he would grant. The trooper missed the whole thing. He turned back to me, a puzzled look on his chest face.
I don't see any... Wait, where did my friend go?
Hmm? I asked. What friend? His impressive mustache twitched.
Eduardo, the ranger.
I feigned confusion.
A ranger? Here? Yes, he was just here.
I'm sure I don't know. The cavern shuddered once again. Sadly, no more obliging chunks of ceiling broke free to crush my last enemy.
Well, the trooper said, maybe he had to leave. You'll excuse me if I have to kill you by myself now. Orders.
Oh, yes, but first.
The trooper was not to be deterred any longer. He grabbed my arm, crushing my ulna and radius together. I screamed. My knees buckled.
Let the girl go!
I whimpered through the pain.
Kill me and let her go!
I surprised myself. These were not the last words I had planned. In the event of my death, I'd been hoping to have time to compose a ballad of my glorious deeds. A very long ballad. Yet here I was, at the end of my life, pleading not for myself, but for Meg McCaffrey. I'd love to take credit for what happened next. I'd like to think my noble gesture of self-sacrifice proved my worthiness and summoned our saviors from the ethereal plane. More likely, though, they were already in the area searching for Meg and heard my scream of agony. With a blood-curdling battle cry, three carpoi hurtled down the tunnel and flew at the trooper, landing on his face. The trooper staggered across the dock, the three peach spirits howling, clawing, and biting like a school of winged fruit-flavored piranhas. Which, in retrospect, I suppose does not make them sound very piranha-like.
Please get off, the trooper wailed. Please and thank you.
The carpoi were not concerned with good manners. After 20 more seconds of savage peachery, the trooper was reduced to a pile of monster ash, tattered fabric, and mustache whiskers. The middle carpos spit out something that might have once been the officer's handgun. He flapped his leafy wings. I deduced that he was our usual friend, the one known as Peaches, because his eyes gleamed a little more viciously, and his diaper sagged a little more dangerously. I cradled my broken arm.
Thank you, Peaches. I don't know how I can ever...
He ignored me and flew to Meg's side. He wailed and stroked her hair. The other two carpoi studied me with a hungry gleam in their eyes.
Peaches?
I whimpered.
Could you tell them I'm a friend? Please?
Peaches howled inconsolably. He scraped dirt and rubble around Meg's legs, the way one might plant a sapling.
Peaches,
I called again.
I can help her. I need to get her back to the way station, the throne of memory.
Nausea made the world tilt and twist. My vision went green. Once I could focus again, I found Peaches and the other two carpoi standing in a line, all staring at me.
Peaches, demanded Peaches.
Yes, I groaned. We need to get her to Indianapolis quickly. If you and your friends... I don't think we've been properly introduced. I'm Apollo.
Peaches pointed to his friend on the right.
Peaches.
Then to the baby demon on his left.
Peaches.
I see. I tried to think. Agony spiked up my arm into my jaw.
Now listen. I have a car. A red Mercedes nearby. If I can get to it, I can drive Meg to...
I looked down at my broken forearm. It was turning some beautiful shades of purple and orange, like an Aegean sunset. I realized I wasn't going to be driving anywhere. My mind began sinking into a sea of pain under that lovely sunset.
Be with you in a minute,
I muttered. Then I passed out. 38. Way station damaged. Commodus will pay for this. And I don't take cash. I remember very little about the trip back. Somehow Peaches and his two friends carried Meg and me out of the cave and to the Mercedes. More disturbingly, the three carpoi somehow drove us to Indianapolis, while Meg sat muttering and shivering in the passenger seat, and I lay groaning in the back.
Don't ask me how three carpoi combined forces to drive an automobile. I can't tell you which of them used the wheel, the brake, or the gas pedal. It's not the sort of behavior you expect from edible fruit. All I know is that by the time I regained more or less full consciousness, we had reached the city limits. My broken forearm was wrapped in leaves glued together with sap. I had no memory of how this came to pass, but the arm felt better. Still sore, but not excruciating. I counted myself lucky the peach spirits had not tried to plant me and water me. I managed to sit upright just as the peach spirits curbed the Mercedes on Capitol Street. Ahead of us, police cars blocked the road. Large red signs on sawhorses announced, "Gas leak emergency. Thank you for your patience." A gas leak. Leo Valdez had been right again. Assuming he was still alive, he'd be insufferable about this for weeks. A few blocks beyond the barricades, a column of black smoke rose from the approximate location of the way station. My heart fractured more painfully than my arm. I glanced at the Mercedes' dashboard clock. We had been gone less than 4 hours. It felt like a lifetime, a godly lifetime. I scanned the sky. I saw no reassuring bronze dragon flying overhead, no helpful griffins defending their nest. If the way station had fallen. No, I had to think positive. I wouldn't let my fears attract any more prophetic bee swarms today. Peaches, I said, I need you. I turned my gaze forward and nearly jumped through the car ceiling. Peaches and his two friends were staring at me, their chins in a line atop the back of the driver's seat like, see no evil, peel no evil, and eat no evil. Yes. Hi, I said. Please, I need you to stay with Meg. Protect her at all costs. Peaches Prime bared his razor-sharp teeth and snarled.
Peaches.
I took this as agreement. I have to check on our friends at the way station, I said. If I don't come back. The words stuck in my throat. Then you'll have to search for the throne of memory. Getting Meg into that chair is the only way to heal her mind. I stared at the three pairs of glowing green eyes. I couldn't tell if the carpoy understood what I was saying, and I didn't know how they could possibly follow my instructions. If the battle was over and the throne of memory had been taken or destroyed. No, that was bee pollen thinking. Just take care of her, I pleaded. I stepped out of the car and valiantly threw up on the sidewalk. Pink emojis danced across my eyes. I hobbled down the street, my arm covered in sap and leaves, my damp clothes smelling of bat guano and snake excrement. It was not my most glorious charge into battle. No one stopped me at the barricades. The officers on duty, regular mortals, I guessed, looked more interested in their smartphone screens than in the smoke rising behind them. Perhaps the mist concealed the true situation. Perhaps they figured if a ragged street person wanted to stumble toward a gas leak emergency, they weren't going to stop him. Or perhaps they were engrossed in an epic Pokemon Go gym battle. A block inside the cordon zone, I saw the first burning bulldozer. I suspected it had driven over a landmine, specially modified by Leo Valdez, since along with being half demolished and in flames, it was also splattered with smiley face stickers and gobs of whipped cream. I hobbled faster. I spotted more disabled bulldozers, scattered rubble, totaled cars, and piles of monster dust, but no bodies. That raised my spirits a little. Just around the corner from the Union Station roundabout, I heard clanging swords ahead, then a gunshot, and something that sounded like thunder. I had never been so happy to hear a battle in progress. It meant not everyone was dead.
I ran. My weary legs screamed in protest. Every time my shoes hit the pavement, a jarring pain shot up my forearm. I turned the corner and found myself in combat. Charging toward me with murder in his eyes was a demigod warrior, some teenage boy I'd never seen, wearing Roman-style armor over his street clothes. Fortunately, he'd already been badly beaten up. His eyes were almost swollen shut. His bronze chest plate was dented like a metal roof after a hailstorm. He could barely hold his sword. I wasn't in much better shape, but I was running on anger and desperation. I managed to unsling my ukulele and slam the demigod in the face. He crumpled at my feet. I was feeling pretty proud of my heroic act until I looked up. In the middle of the roundabout, on top of the fountain and surrounded by cyclopes, my favorite graduate accounting student, Olujime, stood like an ancient war god, swinging a bronze weapon that resembled a double-wide hockey stick. Each sweep sent crackling tendrils of electricity through his enemies. Every hit disintegrated a cyclops. I liked Jamie even more now. I never had much affection for cyclopes. Still, something was strange about his use of lightning. I could always recognize the power of Zeus in action. I'd been zapped by his bolts often enough. Jamie's electricity was different. A more humid scent of ozone, a darker red hue to the flashes. I wished I could ask him about that, but he looked a little busy. Smaller fights raged here and there across the roundabout. The waystation's defenders appeared to have the upper hand. Hunter Kowalski leaped from foe to foe, shooting down Blemyai, wolf-headed warriors, and wild centaurs with ease. She had an uncanny ability to fire on the move, avoid counterstrikes, and target her victims' kneecaps. As an archer, I was impressed. If I'd still had my godly powers, I would have blessed her with fabulous prizes, like a magic quiver, and possibly a signed copy of my greatest hits anthology on classic vinyl. In the hotel drive-thru, Sarah, the Dracaena, sat propped against a mailbox. Her snake-tail legs curled around her, her neck swollen to the size of a basketball. I ran to her aid, afraid she might be wounded. Then I realized the lump in her throat was in the shape of a Gallic war helmet. Her chest and belly were also quite bloated. She smiled at me lazily.
Sup?
Sarah, I said, did you swallow a Germanus whole?
No.
She belched. The smell was definitely barbarian, with a hint of clove.
Well, perhaps.
Where are the others? I ducked as a silver arrow flew over my head, shattering the windshield of a nearby Subaru. Where's Commodus? Sarah pointed toward the waystation.
In there, I think. He killed a path into the building.
She didn't sound too concerned about this, probably because she was sated and sleepy. The pillar of dark smoke I'd noticed earlier was pouring from a hole in the roof of the waystation. Even more distressing, lying across the green shingles like an insect part stuck on flypaper, was a detached bronze wing of a dragon. Rage boiled inside me. Whether the Sun Chariot or Festus or a school bus, no one messes with my ride. The main doors of the Union Station building had been blown wide open. I charged inside, past piles of monster dust and bricks, burning pieces of furniture and a centaur hanging upside down, kicking and whinnying in a net trap. In one stairwell, a wounded hunter of Artemis groaned in pain as a comrade bound her bleeding leg. A few feet farther on, a demigod I didn't recognize lay unmoving on the floor. I knelt next to him. A boy of about 16, my mortal age. I felt no pulse. I didn't know whose side he had fought on, but that didn't matter. Either way, his death was a terrible waste. I had begun to think that perhaps demigod lives were not as disposable as we gods like to believe. I ran through more corridors, trusting the way station to send me in the right direction. I burst into the library where I'd sat last night. The scene within hit me like the explosion from one of Britomartis's bouncing mines. Lying across the table was the body of a griffin. With a sob of horror, I rushed to her side. Heloise's left wing was folded across her body like a shroud. Her head lay bent at an unnatural angle. The floor around her was piled with broken weapons, dented armor, and monster dust. She had died fighting off a host of enemies. But she had died. My eyes burned. I cradled her head, breathing in the clean smell of hay and molting feathers. Oh, Heloise, you saved me. Why couldn't I save you? Where was her mate, Abelard? Was their egg safe? I wasn't sure which thought was more terrible. The whole family of griffins dead, or the father and the griffin chick forced to live with the devastating loss of Heloise. I kissed her beak. Proper grieving would have to wait. Other friends might still be in need of help. With newfound energy, I bounded up a staircase, two steps at a time. I stormed through a set of doors into the main hall. The scene was eerily calm. Smoke flooded out the gaping hole of the roof, billowing from the loft where a smoldering bulldozer chassis was, inexplicably, lodged nose down. Heloise and Abelard's nest appeared to be intact, but there were no signs of the male griffin or the egg. In Josephine's workshop area, sprawled across the floor, lay the severed head and neck of Festus. His ruby eyes dark and lifeless. The rest of his body was nowhere to be seen. Sofas had been smashed and overturned. Kitchen appliances were riddled with bullet holes. The scope of damage was heartbreaking. But the most serious problem was the standoff around the dining table. On the side nearest me stood Josephine Calypso, Laterces, and Thalia Grace. Thalia had her bow drawn. Lit brandished his sword. Calypso raised her bare hands, martial arts style, and Josephine hefted her submachine gun, Little Bertha. On the far side of the table stood Commodus himself, smiling brilliantly despite a bleeding diagonal cut across his face. Imperial gold armor gleamed over his purple tunic. He held his blade, a gold spatha, casually at his side. To either side of him stood a Germanus bodyguard. The barbarian on the right had his arm clamped around Emmy's neck, his other hand pressing a pistol crossbow against Emmy's head. Georgina stood with her mother, Emmy hugging the little girl tightly to her chest.